It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday has arrived once again with Dennis Goldford today, professor and chair in the Department of Political Science at Drake University, also Flansburg Fellow for the Harkin Institute of Public Policy and Citizen Engagement. Thank you for stepping into our Des Moines studio, Dennis.
It's a pleasure, Ben.
Chris Larimer with us, associate professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Chris in our Cedar Falls studio. Great to have you along.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
Later in the hour, gentlemen, just a heads up to you and to our listeners. I want to talk about this controversy over the GOP possibly stonewalling any Supreme Court nominee that Hillary Clinton would send to the Senate should she become the next president. Also, is 2016 the year that Democrats lose their slim majority in the Iowa Senate? Remember, they just have a one-seat advantage there. We'll talk about that in a few minutes this hour. But first, we want to talk about electoral integrity. Donald Trump has made repeated attacks. You've heard him over the past few days, actually going back more than that, weeks. He calls it a rigged election. This, despite the fact that elections here in the United States are run largely by county clerks and are overseen by elected secretaries of state, just like here in Iowa. Many of them are Republicans, just like here in Iowa. Now, Donald Trump has called on supporters to turn out in droves on Election Day to monitor polling places, telling them they need to be vigilant against widespread voter fraud and a rigged outcome. Well, let's listen to a few of his comments, now accusing also the media of being in on this sort of conspiracy. Here's a montage of audio from his rallies compiled by Fox News.
The election is rigged.
It's a rigged system. It's a rigged election. This is a rigged system, folks. The process is rigged. This whole election is being rigged. These lies spread by the media without witnesses, without backup or anything else, are poisoning the minds of the electorate.
Now, during his press conference yesterday, President Obama told Trump to stop whining about the election. Listen.
There is no serious person out there who would suggest somehow that you could even rig America's elections, in part because they're so decentralized and the numbers of votes involved. There's no evidence that that has happened in the past, or that there are instances in which that will happen this time. And so I'd advise Mr. Trump to stop whining and go try to make his case to get votes. And if he got the most votes, then it would be my expectation of Hillary Clinton to offer a gracious concession speech and pledge to work with him in order to make sure that the American people benefit from an effective government. And it would be my job to welcome Mr. Trump, regardless of what he said about me or my differences with him on my opinions, and escort him over to the Capitol, in which there would be a peaceful transfer of power. That's what Americans do. That's why America's already great. One way of weakening America and making it less great is if you start betraying those basic American traditions that have been bipartisan and have helped to hold together this democracy now for well over two centuries.
President Obama addressing the charges of widespread fraud in the coming election, charges launched by Donald Trump. Dennis Goldford, tell us here. I mean, do we need to address the question if there's any validity to Trump's claims first?
You know, there are a lot of things about this election cycle that I find repulsive. But this is something that gets me angry. I've studied the American constitutional system and election system for my whole career, which is lengthy. Chris is a very smart young whippersnapper in this business, but very bright. But I've looked at this for a long time, and we have someone who makes insinuations, makes allegations without a shred of evidence. There is absolutely no evidence that there is any widespread systematic, centralized organization for rigging elections. There are always errors that are made. But Trump is making these claims. Interestingly, he's the Republican nominee, and Republicans have always rightly prided themselves as the party of personal responsibility. Trump is someone who takes credit for everything and responsibility for nothing. So if he loses this election, it can't possibly be due to his campaign and his failings. It's got to be that somebody stole this from him. This is something I find outrageous and dangerously inflammatory.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to, I mentioned at the outset there that, you know, because of our decentralized system, the president said, too, that it would be virtually impossible to steal an election because they're run by county clerks, secretaries of state. Ours is a Republican. Monday morning in a press conference, our governor, Terry Branstad, and Iowa Secretary of State Paul Pate tried to reassure voters in the wake of Trump's comments. Let's listen to them. First, Governor Branstad, then Paul Pate.
The integrity of our electoral process is critically important. And a lot of people are very skeptical today because they see the bias of the national press. They see what they consider to be collusion between the Clinton machine.
I can say to Mr. Trump and to others and to Iowans, we're going to have a fair, open election this November. Your vote will be counted if you're an eligible elector.
Okay, Paul Pate there, Iowa Secretary of State. Before that, Governor Branstad addressing the other facet of this, which is the claim of media collusion there. Chris Larimer, jump in here on these two facets, the latest claims by Donald Trump.
Well, I think what Dennis said is absolutely correct as far as there are errors, but absolutely no evidence of widespread voter fraud. The other side of this is that there is some evidence in political science showing that when you start to break down voters' confidence in the sanctity of elections, when you start to challenge the confidence that they have in the secrecy of their ballot, there's actually some evidence to show that they may be less likely to register to vote. If they don't believe their ballot's going to be kept secret, they may be less likely to show up at the polls if they think the election is rigged, or if they think turnout is going to be lower than expected based on what other people are doing. So there are some real behavioral implications to continuing with this rhetoric that I think those conversations need to be talked about more, because if you're starting to, shake people's confidence in the election, that affects how they behave in the lead up to Election Day and on Election Day.
Mm-hmm. And we can see, judging by this poll from Politico Morning Consult, it seems to be having an impact. The American electorate has turned skeptical about the integrity of the nation's election system. 41% of voters saying that this coming election could be stolen from Donald Trump due to widespread voter fraud. Again, that's a Politico Morning Consult poll. About 2,000 registered voters across the country. The poll taken October 13th through the 15th. 73% of Republicans polled in this 2,000 number think the election could be swiped from him. 17% of Democrats agree with the prospect of massive fraud at the ballot box. Dennis, how much historical precedent is there for a president making such claims?
Well, number one, Republicans, even those who do not like Donald Trump, of whom there are many, have been fostering this claim for quite a number of years. There's been a kind of irrefutable premise that because there really is a Republican majority in the country, no Democratic presidential candidate can win a fair election. Therefore, if the Democrat seems to have won, by definition, the election must not have been fair or must not have been honest. Now, the initial premise is false. But we have to remember, and of course that's one of the reasons for all the concerns with this chimera of voter fraud that we've seen since 2010, when Republicans took over a lot of state legislatures. They're arguing against the integrity of Republican appointed officials, which is crazy. But we have to remember, broadly speaking, that elections work only when the loser agrees to lose. And that doesn't happen in most countries around the world. If the government loses, they oftentimes say, we don't accept that result. They send in the troops and crack down. If the outgroup loses, they say, we don't accept the results. They arm themselves and take to the hills. In 1861, In this country, the losers did not agree to lose. That caused, of course, the Civil War. And actually, it was the election of 1800, once political parties had formed by the end of Washington's second administration. No, I was not in that administration, but I knew people who were. The in-party, the Federalists, lost that election and went to the House in 1800, and hence the whole history of Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr and so forth. But the Federalist Party lost that election, and they agreed to give up power. And it was only then when people started to think, maybe this new constitutional system will work. But by challenging the legitimacy of a potential loss on Mr. Trump's part, he and his supporters call into question the integrity of the entire American constitutional system.
Join our conversation with Dennis Goldford and Chris Larimer as we discuss the latest politics, included in that, first up to bat, Donald Trump's claims, repeated attacks on what he's calling a rigged election. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Perhaps you don't have confidence that your vote will count. Well, join us to share your concerns. 1-866-780-9100, river to river, at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Tom joins us. He dialed 1-866-780-9100. Tom in Des Moines, hi.
Yes, good day to you. It's not a great day when we have a candidate like Donald Trump acting like the canary in the coal mine for our democracy. We should have recognized a long time ago that this person was a chronic exaggerator, if not an outright liar and a fraud, and we should have challenged him long, long ago. And now he's come up with his most preposterous lie ever about the election being fixed. Well, maybe that's not true. The birther lie was probably the most preposterous. But he is the canary in the coal mine. Our response to him determines the direction our democracy is going to go in.
Mm-hmm. And of the response that you've heard so far, what do you think, Tom?
Well, I think the media has totally dropped the ball, just to use the old sports metaphor. They didn't start vetting him until after he became the nominee of a Republican Party, and they had this fair, balanced, and objective value system that I think I challenged this on a previous program, where you've had journalism professors come in and say these are the values of journalism, and they're not the values that should be. The values of journalism should be to protect the public good and to be of public service to people.
Okay, Tom. Okay. Thank you. Thank you for your view from Des Moines. 1-866-780-9100. So what could be other motives? What is this? The impact here? I've been reading Chris Larimer. When we hear Donald Trump calling on supporters to turn out in droves on election day to monitor polling places, you have to be trained to do that, or how does that happen? Can anybody show up to monitor polling places without training?
Well, you can certainly try to monitor, but you need to contact the local elections office to request to be a poll watcher. And then that's different to being a precinct election official, where you're actually there working the polls, taking people's names, and passing out ballots. But you could be a poll watcher, but you still need to contact the elections office and make sure that, you know, oftentimes you'll get a badge or something to hang around your neck just to let them know that you're a poll watcher and there just to watch the poll, watch turnout numbers. For instance, a number of organizations do that already. But there's a story in today's New York Times talking about that, despite all these claims by Donald Trump, you know, his supporters really aren't registering with local precincts to be able to do that. But I want to pick up on one other point that Dennis mentioned, which I think is really important, mm-hmm. is that there's a scholar by the name of Tom Tyler who's done a lot of work on. He has a classic book as far as why people obey the law, why people will do things even if they don't really want to do them. And what he finds is that, you know, people are willing to pay, you know, parking tickets, speeding tickets, you know, even pay taxes, as long as they believe that the process is a fair process, right? And so if Trump's starting to talk about things like challenging the legitimacy of the election process, challenging, you know, the way votes are count, for people who participate in the election and buy into that rhetoric, you know, they're going to be, the research suggests they're less likely to accept the final outcome, whatever it might be. And so I think, you know, again, that creates real problems post-election day if this continues.
Mm-hmm. So what does that What are our, in light of this, what are our concerns post-election? Should Hillary Clinton, as many polls are indicating, win the White House, Dennis?
Well, I think, even independently of Donald Trump, if you had had a more conventional Republican candidate with a Republican nomination...
Dennis, we'll give you a chance there to cough just a minute. Let's go to Joe in Iowa City, a number of callers. Let's go to Joe. He dialed 1-866-780-9100.
Hello, gentlemen. Thanks for taking the call. Just a quick observation. I find myself listening to Trump and wish that he would dial back the fraud and go more towards the approach that Elizabeth Warren, I think, took during the recent DNC convention when she mentioned, in fact, that the system is rigged.
Right.
And what I mean by that is there's always been small pockets of fraud, right, in elections, and there probably always will be. But I think in terms of the system being rigged, looking at, and we don't know the authenticity, but the leaks coming out of WikiLeaks in terms of the inner workings and the collaboration and the collusion between DNC and the Clinton campaign, the idea that it is just proprietary to the Clinton campaign, that sort of thing is not part of the RNC with the Trump campaign is just preposterous, that this doesn't exist and that it always doesn't exist, which I don't think makes it fraud, but in terms of things being rigged, I think right. We all know that these things go on behind the scenes, they have forever. But he's not, I don't think he's helping his case by talking about there being fraud. It could just be that one political party is better at walking up to the line and always has been, and maybe bending that a little bit or tiptoeing over. But fraud, not so much. Rigging, absolutely.
Appreciate your comments. Thanks, Joe, in Iowa City. Of course, it matters how you define rigged here. Donald Trump very clearly defining rigging, unlike Bernie Sanders did, as outright widespread voter fraud. I don't know, Dennis, are you back on board?
I'm back. Sorry about that.
That's all right.
It
has happened to me on the air as well. So you were making the point.
Right. I was going to say that if Hillary Clinton were facing a more conventional Republican candidate, number one, she'd be much more likely to lose. Again, we've said before that Donald Trump's probably the one Republican that Hillary Clinton could beat, even as she's the one Democrat that Donald Trump could beat. But even if she were to win against a conventional Republican, we would be likely looking at more gridlock because of Republican continuing control in the House, and we don't know how the Senate will go, but even if it goes Democratic, they won't have a filibuster-proof majority. So we're not out of the woods, even if she were to win elections in terms of policy and moving things forward. But the concern is, in terms of what would happen if, in fact, he lost, you have newspapers like the Dallas Morning News, the Omaha World Herald, the Arizona Republic, that never endorsed Democrats, and they've always endorsed Republicans. They've endorsed Hillary Clinton this time, or at least said, don't vote for Donald Trump. But the Arizona Republic, as many listeners will know, they've already received death threats. And this is what's dangerous, that Trump does represent a legitimate problem in the country. There are people who believe themselves to have been left behind or are being left behind by the pace of economic, cultural, social change. And there are real problems there and real angers and fears and hurts. No question about that. But what he's doing is pouring gasoline on burning coals that could spiral out of control. And he seems to encourage this. That's the danger.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Travis in Coralville. Travis dialed 1-866-780-9100. Travis, what's your input here?
Yeah, I would like to get the panelists' input on whether they think Mr. Trump is intentionally trying to keep voter turnout lower, because I remember back from my political science days that generally the larger the electorate, the more Democratic it tends to be, especially in the presidential elections. So I'd like their comments on that.
Okay. We touched on the fringe of that a little bit earlier. Chris, can you take that up? What could be a possible outcome, even if the voter fraud, since the voter fraud is unsupported, what is the reason for making such claims?
Well, Travis is right that, generally in a presidential election year, if turnout goes up, that generally favors the Democratic candidate just based on the demographics of the electorate that are showing up. But, as we talked about, the danger there, if he starts to challenge the legitimacy here, and as Dennis, laid out very, very beautifully, is that, you know, if he shakes people's confidence in the election, there's a chance that a number of voters won't show up, or they're going to show up and show up to vote for the very first time and feel like their voice didn't matter. And we know from, you know, a lot of research, when people feel like their voice doesn't matter, they're very upset and less likely to accept the outcome. So I think that's the danger. We don't know necessarily what it's going to do to turnout, but I think it's more accepting the outcome after the election day that is potentially the real problem there. And you know, the previous caller made a really good point about what Trump is doing. From a public opinion perspective, it doesn't make a lot of sense to attack the election process itself because, you know, as far as what level of government Americans hold most dear, it's local government, right? We have our highest opinion of local government. Yet when you're challenging elections and the rigging of elections, that's local government that's administering it. That's, you know, local county election offices. And so he's attacking the one aspect of government that Americans actually tend to approve of.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Cedar Rapids. Alan joining us, listening in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Alan. We are coming up
on a
break. I'll have to ask you to make it brief, but thanks for being on our show.
Thank you very much. My question is, in 2000, every Democrat I ran into challenged the George W. Bush voter count and said that Al Gore won the election, and it was a whole mishmash between the Supreme Court. And my question is, did Hillary Clinton at that time, you know, feel the same way that Donald Trump's kind of saying now? He's saying it before the election, but after the election for about 4 years, all I could hear from my Democratic friends was, hey, George W. Bush was not duly elected.
Okay, let's get an answer before the break. Alan, thanks for your call from Cedar Rapids. Dennis, you want to tackle that quickly?
That there were technical problems with the hanging chads and all that sort of thing. There was no allegation, I recall, of any kind of systematic attempt to rig the election.
Mm-hmm. Right, and voters seemed to accept it. They were frustrated by it, but they accepted it and seemed to move on.
Yeah, Al Gore said, basically, I don't like the result, but for the good of the country, it's time to move on.
Right.
And would Donald Trump do that?
Okay, so to put these side by side, they're just too dissimilar?
Yes, I think
yes.
So.
Okay. We'll be back in just a moment with Dennis Goldford of Drake University and Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa. When we come back, we'll move on to the Supreme Court back in politics. John McCain, Senator McCain from Arizona, saying he would be united against any Supreme Court nominee that Hillary Clinton sends to the Senate. He walked that back, or rather his spokesperson did, and Chuck Grassley made a comment about it yesterday. That he would not stonewall any person that she should nominate for the Supreme Court. We'll also talk about the Iowa Senate. Is 2016 the year that the Iowa Senate goes into Republican hands? It's in a slim Democratic majority right now. We'll come back in just a moment with Dennis Goldford and Chris Larimer. Politics Wednesday. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a moment. We're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Dennis Goldford of Drake University with us, and Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa. Hope you'll join us. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. In the first part of our program, addressing the charges, unfounded charges that Donald Trump has launched repeatedly, calling it a rigged election, wanting his followers to be vigilant against widespread voter fraud and rigged outcome. Let's move on to some other political news this week. We had in an interview with Republican John McCain on CNN Monday, Senator from Arizona, of course, he said he'd unite with Republicans to block a Hillary Clinton Supreme Court nominee. Let's listen.
We will be united against any Supreme Court nominee that that Hillary Clinton, if she were president, would put up. And I promise you, this is why we need the majority.
Okay. Now, a McCain spokeswoman later said McCain would, quote, thoroughly examine the record of any person Clinton might nominate and vote for or against that person based on the record, walking it back a bit there. The chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee is our own Senator Charles Grassley. He said yesterday, if Hillary Clinton wins the presidential election, he won't stonewall her Supreme Court nominees, but that he will vet any nominees that come after the election.
We would hope that you would have somebody that's going to be dispassionate, unlike Breyer and Ginsburg and Kagan and Sotomayor, that vote is a block all the time on an ideological way.
Okay. Senator Grassley yesterday. Dennis Goldford, with your expertise over decades in constitutional law and so forth, and what do you make of McCain's remarks and then the walk back of those remarks?
Well, remember Michael Kinsley's famous comment that a gaffe is not accidentally saying something you don't believe. A gaffe is accidentally saying something you, in fact, do believe but didn't want people to know about. And I was rather surprised by Senator McCain because he's always been an institutionalist and respectful of the powers of the various branches of government. And to say at first that you're not going to consider any nominee put forward by a President Clinton, let's leave aside the whole issue with Merrick Garland and President Obama, that's not an advice and consent function with regard to a particular nominee. That's a challenge to the president's constitutional authority and duty to send up nominees for Senate consideration. That's suggesting that the president does not have that power that's listed very explicitly under Article 2 of the Constitution. That, I think, is why Senator McCain has tried to walk that back against. That doesn't mean that they won't decide that every given nominee President Clinton sends up would be unacceptable. But they have to decide, ultimately, do Republicans want to be the party of no and the party of obstruction, or do they want to be a governing party and help participate in making the government run?
Okay, so Senator Grassley, the GOP's leadership's position on this had been, up to this point, let the people decide in the election who should pick the next justices. Now, should Hillary Clinton become the next president, she chooses the nominees that have to be okayed by the Senate. Dennis, what do you see as the farthest that the GOP could go in blocking any nominees? Do you think that's likely? But theoretically, what could they do? I mean, we've already seen them do something unprecedented by holding up the Merrick Garland nomination, haven't they?
Well, sure. Theoretically, they could continue doing that. And, you know, Senator Grassley wanted to say there is a political principle that a lame duck president should not send up a nominee or should not be considered. There is no such principle. It's simply power politics, and it's something that Democrats probably would do themselves in similar circumstances. So there's no principle at stake. So the question is whether, in fact, the Republicans who blocked Garland on the view that no, the next president should choose, whether they're true to the word, to their word, or whether they will be exposed as hypocrites.
Mm-hmm. Review for us very quickly, Dennis, because of your expertise. Tell us the very, in a nutshell, the basic difference between the way a Republican sees the Supreme Court justice and the way Democrats see its Supreme Court justice in their view of the Constitution.
Oh, boy.
Can you put that in a nutshell, or is that too difficult? Because we have constructionalists, these titles thrown around, activists, judges, and so forth. What is the basic difference?
Well, the position taken by Justice Scalia, Justice Thomas, for example, is that the Constitution should be understood in the terms in which a given provision was understood when it was written and ratified. And Democrats say that the phrase living Constitution isn't the most helpful, although Justice Scalia once said he's in favor of a dead Constitution. Their view is that what the words of the Constitution mean have to mean what we understand them to mean in contemporary times.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's move on to an area that, Chris, I know you've been looking into a great deal, the presidential race, of course, capturing most of the attention this election cycle. However, 25 seats in the 50-seat chamber of our Iowa Senate here in the Iowa legislature, that'll be on the ballot. And since the start of 2011, Democrats in the Iowa Senate have held a narrow 26-24 majority out of 50 seats. Now, that's held up for the Democrats through the 2012 election, through the 2014 election. And the question is, will it hold for these 2016 elections? Chris, you've been looking into some data on the most vulnerable Iowa Senate seats. What did you find?
Well, I think the first part of that is to follow up on what you just mentioned. The Senate Democrats have held that 26-seat majority following, you know, they lost six seats in 2010 to go from 32 down to 26 in that narrow majority, but they held it through 2012, they held it through 2014, and that's despite a lot of political scientists who study state politics saying that the Iowa Senate is one of those chambers that's going to flip, and it hasn't done that. And actually, the Iowa Senate Democrats have not lost a seat in a presidential election year the last four presidential cycles, so 2000, 2004, 2008, and 2012. And the fact that they didn't lose seats in 2014 in a pretty big Republican year in Iowa and across the country suggests, you know, they may not, Iowa Senate Democrats may not lose seats again, even though there are, by party registration numbers, some very vulnerable seats. So I think that's important to separate. And the other part of it is when you talk to Senate candidates who are running, as they've talked to voters through door knocking, you know, a lot of voters do seem to separate state house seats from what's going on the presidential level. They look more at the individual candidates. Having said that, you know, you can look at the differences in party registration in, you know, all 15 seat, or all 25 seats that are up this election cycle. And what's interesting, at least this cycle, is that you have seven seats where the difference between registered Democrats and registered Republicans is within plus or minus 2.5 percentage points. And all seven of those seats are currently held by Democratic incumbents. And they're Democratic incumbents who have been or are currently in the leadership. So some of the bigger names that listeners might recognize in terms of Senator Gronstall, you know, Senator Mathis, Senator Shanejohn, and others. So that's an interesting side of it. And I think on the whole, if you look at it, the 13 Republican seats are up. Their average party registration advantage, if you want to call it, is about 15 points. For the 12 Democrats that are up, their party registration advantage is less than half that, at 7 points. So, you know, just looking at party registration numbers, you would think that this is going to be a difficult year for Senate Democrats, and it very well may be, but 2014 was also a difficult year, and we didn't see any change in the overall majority numbers as far as 26-24.
So it will come down to turnout, Chris?
I think so. And again, if you think about it in terms of presidential election years, where about on average 450,000 more Iowans show up at the polls in a presidential election year compared to a midterm year, you know, that may be enough to carry Senate Democrats through the election and retain that 26-24 advantage.
Okay, let's still imagine what that would look like if the GOP does gain control of the Senate. That means Republicans have all three. They'll have the executive
assuming
branch.
The House.
The House. That's firmly in GOP hands, right, Chris?
I would think it would probably stay that way. I'd be surprised if there was that big of a swing.
Okay, so if the Senate goes over to the GOP, it would, by appearances, be in an optimal position to pass legislation into law that they haven't been up to this point. What would we likely see at the top of their list? Any thought to that?
Well, it's kind of hard to say. I mean, I think you would see some changes in certain policies. You may see changes in funding priorities, whether it's I'd be surprised if they really go after some social issues, but they may start to look at labor bills, education bills, other social services bills. That haven't received as much attention as they would have liked, that have been blocked by the Iowa Senate. But you have to remember, governing with unified government is not always as easy as it sounds. And when you have unified government, it's very easy to point the finger at a particular party or a particular person as the reason to blame for not getting things done. So, right, if we think back to unified government under Governor Culver, he had it for 4 years, but he lost his reelection bid. They weren't always able to get things done that they wanted to. And so having unified government also means that, you know, some of the more extreme ends of the party can start to push things that maybe are not going to play as well with a broader electorate. So, you know, there's a little bit of give and take there.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if we can, though, look for indications of how it would be, looking around at any other, perhaps, Midwest states where there are GOP control of both the legislative and executive branches.
Well, I think, you know, what people often look to is Wisconsin, right, and the rollback in collective bargaining, some of the anti-labor bills that were pushed through by Governor Walker in Wisconsin. And I think that's the fear among many Democrats in Iowa, is that there would be that push push here as well for these anti-collective bargaining bills. But I would be surprised, again, if that's the case, because we do see Iowa kind of swinging back and forth at the state level, to some extent at the presidential level, between midterm and presidential elections. So again, if you swing too far to one direction or the other when you have unified government, it can come back to bite you 2 to 4 years later.
Mm-hmm. Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa. Dennis Goldford also with us of Drake University, finishing up our Hour of Politics on this Wednesday. And before we go, of course, tonight, the final debate, it's been called Trump's last stand by some, I guess, the final presidential debate in Las Vegas. And we will be broadcasting that live here on Iowa Public Radio's news stream. And I'd just like to get your thoughts, Dennis and Chris. And Dennis, start us off. What will you be watching for?
Well, I would expect on the Trump side, not so much an attempt to expand the base. That doesn't seem to be where he's gone. He's gone in the direction of trying to double down on the turnout of his core supporters. The problem for the Trump folks is that they're not enough to win an election nationwide. But I would expect him to levy heavy, heavy, heavy attacks at Hillary Clinton. I think that would be more the focus than the rigging issue, although I'm sure that he'll be asked about it, and they'll both be asked about it. On the Clinton side, she's still, and there'll be an attempt, because he's been attacked so heavily lately, I'm sure they'll swing back and try to raise again the undying issue of emails and WikiLeaks and things like that. But the thing that a lot of folks believe Hillary Clinton needs to do, finally, is to articulate some overarching reason why she should be president, why she wants to be president, beyond simply personal ambition. All she offers is a series of individual policies. She offers all these laundry lists of policy X, Y, and Z and so forth. But she's always had, and the WikiLeaks shows internally, they recognize that she's always had a difficulty in articulating an overall rationale for a Clinton presidency.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, how do you think Donald Trump will deal with the inevitable mention of these sexual assault allegations by, I think, something like a dozen women now?
I would imagine he would do what he's done on the stump, was to argue no witnesses and immediately pivot to deny it, argue no witnesses, and then pivot immediately to Bill Clinton and the 90s greatest hits.
Mm. Chris Larimer, what are your expectations for tonight? What will you be watching for?
Well, I think on the substantive side of it, I think Dennis is exactly right in terms of how each candidate's going to approach it. As a political observer, I think, the optics of these things are always fascinating to watch. I mean, between the first and second debate, with the second debate with Donald Trump kind of wandering around the stage, watching some of the nonverbal behavior that's going on, or even some of the verbal behavior with interruptions and those types of things. But I think, as people watch these things, we always have to remember that there's, at least up until this election cycle, maybe that'll change, there's not a lot of evidence that debates have a really significant impact on vote choice, because on the whole, people are watching these through their own partisan lens, right? I mean, you come into these debates with some preconceived notions about each candidate, and you sort of filter the information that they are saying through those lens.
Though the first presidential debate did seem to have an impact when it came to finding out poll numbers days later, didn't it? But, I mean, we do have then decreasing numbers of people watching the debates, don't we?
Well, that could be the case. It also could be what political scientists often talk about as far as, differential response rates, where you have maybe loyal Trump supporters after a poor performance just less likely to respond to a request from pollster than more on-the-fence Trump supporter.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, your point to Dennis about WikiLeaks coming up in tonight's debate. Donald Trump would be do his side well to bring that up with attacks on Secretary Clinton. But this was interesting to read today, that Marco Rubio, in a fierce re-election bid in Florida, Senator Rubio says Republicans are making a mistake by jumping on the alleged hacked emails released by WikiLeaks to criticize Hillary Clinton. In fact, he says he, Marco Rubio, will not talk about the hacked emails at all. Here's a quote. As our intelligence agencies have said, these leaks are an effort by a foreign government to interfere with our electoral process. I will not indulge it. Those are the words of Marco Rubio. He also says, I further want to warn my fellow Republicans who may want to capitalize politically on these leaks. He says, today it's the Democrats, tomorrow it could be us. So Rubio's stand puts him directly at odds with Donald Trump, for sure, but also the Republican National Committee, who have been hammering Hillary Clinton. What do you make of this, Dennis, that Marco Rubio, he's in a tight election, he needs to do what he needs to do to win?
I think that's the case. I mean, Rubio, of course, is someone during the primary season who, aside from various mistakes, said that Donald Trump is a con man and we cannot allow him to be president of the United States, and nonetheless he's endorsed him. So he's trying to walk a very thin line, and I think in saying these things, reflecting, as you correctly noticed, the tightness of the race, you can't win with the Trump folks, you can't win without them. You need something greater than that. But I think he's trying to look for his political future the day after November 8th.
Mm-hmm. The candidates not doing well with facts. Donald Trump in a league of his own with the facts, according to PolitiFact and other nonpartisan organizations. How much does that matter, Chris, in a debate like tonight? The facts, I think Chris Wallace says he's not going to be the fact checker.
Well, I think
the moderator, Chris Wallace.
Right, yeah. I think, you know, I'd go back to what I said earlier. I think, you know, for a lot of people, they have their preconceived notions about these candidates, you know, and they have their own partisan identity, and that's a big part of who they are. If you're watching the debate, you're generally interested in politics, invested in politics. And so, you know, if the information that doesn't fit with your worldview, that doesn't fit with your narrative about a particular candidate, you're going to tend to kind of push to the side and be more likely to accept, information that conforms to what you already think, right? We have these confirmation biases. And so that, I think, significantly affects how you process that information. So even when you have statements that are wildly untrue for, you know, the core Trump supporters, that's not going to make any difference.
Okay, let's go to, I think, what will be our last caller, Dan, calling from Des Moines. Hi, Dan, not much time, but what do you want to say to us?
No, I'll try to be concise. I just wanted to bring this around to the context of the rigging, again, in general. So in my experience, anecdotal at least, my family, some of my family who are Trump supporters, view the rigging from what I see as a lack of information on the electoral process. You know, like my brother was upset with the primary process and how the states weigh delegates differently. So I guess what I'm wondering is renewed political participation from this kind of election that's had a dichotomy of choices, is that going to bring light to how the parties do their business, how they view the primary elections, and is this kind of maybe perceived rigging going to change how future elections take place?
Mm-hmm. And, of course, the primaries, the caucuses, those are in the hands of the respective parties, whereas the general election in local officials' hands. Dennis Goldford, what are your thoughts on Dan's point?
Well, I think on the Republican side, they have the bigger problem. Not only did they ignore the so-called autopsy report after the 2012 defeat in terms of what the party needed to do to try to attract new supporters, especially among young people and minorities, but they believe, a lot of mainstream Republicans believe, the party's been the victim of a hostile takeover, that they've lost control of the nomination process. And so Republicans will try again to exercise more control over the way the primaries work. The Democrats, for better or worse, have bet the farm on Hillary Clinton. They have some cleanup, if you will, to do in terms of how the DNC approached the Sanders challenge to Hillary Clinton. But overall, it's hard to see how any major changes, at least at this point, would occur.
Mm-hmm. Chris, when you're looking at the polls nationally and for the Electoral College, individual states, what do you see? The most likely outcome still working in Hillary Clinton's favor in a big way?
Yeah, I would say it still seems to be that way. If you look at the electoral map, the polls and battleground states, I think what's interesting is that we desperately need more polling in Iowa. We have not had any polls following the release of those tapes with Donald Trump's statements. And so at this point, Iowa is still seems to be the sole battleground state where Trump's lead, at least in terms of the polling averages, is greater than in any other state. And based on those polls, is projected to swing more than any other state from 2012 to 2016. I mean, at this point, you know, we're looking at a potential electoral map, at least based on those pre-tape polls, where Iowa could go Republican, but North Carolina and Arizona could go Democrat, which, again, is just very unusual. And that's why we need, more polling done in Iowa post-tapes, post-second debate.
Dennis, we've got about a minute left. Your thoughts on the polls that you're keeping an eye on?
Polls, as Chris is very well aware, and you are too, Ben, are snapshots at a given moment, and things can change. I mean, there's been a tendency of a lot of people, especially among reporters, to say, well, this is over. Hillary Clinton has won it. This is an ungodly amount of time still in a contentious election where anytime Hillary Clinton opens her mouth, she can have an unforced error. So, I'd rather have Hillary Clinton's numbers right now going into this than Donald Trump's numbers. But I wouldn't count any chickens yet.
Okay. Dennis Goldford, professor and chair the Department of Political Science at Drake University, Flansburgh Fellow for the Harkin Institute of Public Policy and Citizen Engagement. Dennis, thanks for coming into our studio in Des Moines.
Glad to be here, Ben.
Chris Larimer, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa in our Cedar Falls studio. Always great to have you as well, Chris.
Thank you very much.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Also help from Divine Huff and from Tony Daner in Cedar Falls and John Pemble in Des Moines. Tomorrow, we'll talk about the frequency of severe flooding events in Iowa being on the rise. Perhaps you've been affected by flooding and would like to join us. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.